Mark Steiner here on the Mark Steiner Show, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We want you to still join us on the show at 410-319-8888. We want to take your calls. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner or at Kay Whitehead. You can send us an email to talk@steinershow.org, or you can leave us a note on our Facebook page. Your comments are important, and we want to hear them. I am so excited about our guest in the studio. When you talk about activism on the ground, when you talk about being ready to make a change, when you talk about standing up for what you believe in, you've got to mention the name Davon Love, who's the Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Good morning, Mr. Love. Thank
you
for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
So we're going to talk about what is happening with legislation around police accountability. So in January, a task force approved 22 recommendations aimed at restoring trust in law enforcement. This is a bill that would grant more rights to victims of police brutality, roll back special rights given to police who are accused of wrongdoing, create a unified complaint system. Can you talk to us a bit about the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights? What exactly is that for people who are not familiar
Absolutely.
With it?
Absolutely. So the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights was codified in 1974, and it gives, it's in the context of workers' rights, so, you know, rights for police officers. And the idea, the issue is that it gives law enforcement officials rights above and beyond their constitutional rights. But more importantly, what it does is that it undermines the ability to get transparency and accountability for law enforcement that engage in police brutality. And so, for instance, one of the things that exists now is that if an officer is alleged to have engaged in brutality, the three-person trial board that determines discipline is made up solely of law enforcement officials.
Okay.
Right? Or the internal investigation can only be made up of other sworn law enforcement officials. So these are two kind of major elements that undermine accountability. So those 22 recommendations that you talked about, there was a task force that was convened after the uprising by the leadership in the legislature of Annapolis, Senate President Mike Miller and Speaker of the House of Delegates Michael Bush. The 22 recommendations, and they were originally 23, but these recommendations were transformed into a bill, a leadership bill, that's supposed to have these kind of sweeping changes to law enforcement. Here's the problem, is that of those 22 recommendations, they did not deal directly with the kinds of reforms that would give community the power to be involved in the discipline of law enforcement officials if they've engaged in brutality. So essentially, even though so for instance, one of the things they changed in the leadership bill originally, you know, you only had 90 days to file a complaint from the incident. They want to change it from a year to day.
So people can have a little bit more time.
Have more time.
Is that so they could think about it, get their courage up, be able to, I mean, well, why do they need more time rather than just having 90 days?
I mean, a part of the reason for that is sometimes in brutality instances, officers in retribution will charge you with assault of an officer.
Oh, okay.
You got to go through the process of getting that settled. And then that's, you know, and that takes longer than 90 days typically.
Okay.
So that's one of the good things that was in the bill. You know, there's this 10-day rule that folks have been talking about where officers have 10 days before they're required to make a statement on the record. That's been negotiated down to 5 days.
Now, let's just talk about that for a second, because that's been a big concern that was talked about a lot after, you know, the uprising from last year. This notion that if you commit a crime, if I did something to someone, I don't have 10 days to think about my story, to get witnesses, to figure it out. I've got to go in immediately and be held accountable.
Absolutely.
So are you talking about cutting that from 10 days to no waiting period, or are you talking about a shorter period?
For folks like myself, you know, feel the way you feel, which is there doesn't need to be any days, right?
Right, because either you did it or you didn't.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Now, so those are a few of the things that are in the leadership bill. The issue that we're having right now, though, is that the things that will have the biggest impact on police accountability is to change the dynamic where the decisions made about discipline are in-house amongst law enforcement. Currently, there's no civilian that is allowed to be involved in the process of discipline. Right. So that the leadership bill, it does all these things in terms of training, the 90 days I mentioned, the 10 days to 5 days I mentioned. But it doesn't in its original form does not address having a civilian on the trial board, which for us is one of the most important things you have to do. The whole point of police reform is to stop the practice of police policing themselves.
Right.
Right. If you don't change police policing themselves, then you don't have accountability. They're still able to do things in-house amongst each other. One of the things that's been frustrating, so the session is over April 11th, so the session's about to wind down. This is kind of crunch time, and we've been really trying to push our legislators to include having a civilian on the trial board and having folks outside of law enforcement be involved in the internal investigation, a civilian review board, for instance, be involved in that. And there has been strong pushback, almost as if it's a non-starter for a lot of legislators and law enforcement.
Well, just to have somebody who's a civilian so that the police are not policing themselves.
Exactly.
Somebody's there so they can be held accountable.
Exactly. So it was about a week ago. I was observing a subcommittee meeting of the Judiciary, the House Judiciary Committee. So it's their subcommittee. And Delegate Cluster of Baltimore County made it very clear that, and he's a former police officer,
okay,
made it very clear, no civilians on the trial board. So they negotiated down to a non-voting member on the trial board, right?
And so a civilian could sit on the board but just couldn't vote. I mean, now, do they have any power? So if you can sit and not vote, can you speak out? Can you speak up against something? Can you give policy recommendations? Or are you really just there to take notes?
Exactly. And see, that's part of the problem.
Okay.
And see, so again, it's like the whole point of police reform is to give the community power. So when I testified on the 23rd, you know, one of the things that I explained, and I think people miss this concept, that public safety is a public good, right? It is a service that is rendered to a community. And it's up to the community to determine whether they feel like that service is being rendered effectively. The dynamic that we're dealing with in Annapolis is this idea of law enforcement kind of as its own industry dictating whether or not the service being rendered is satisfactory when it's up to the community to make that decision. And what we've been saying is that this is the analogy that they use, that the opposition use. They say, well, doctors are evaluated by doctors, lawyers are evaluated by lawyers, so police should be evaluated by police. And the argument that I keep making, and I have heard no substantive pushback against this, if I don't like a doctor, right, I can just go to another doctor. If I'm a lawyer, I can just go to another lawyer. But public safety, I can't buy into one package of public safety and another.
And go get another police officer.
Right.
I have what you've given me.
Right. And so the only mechanism of oversight would be to have a civilian on the trial board as a part of checking, making sure that the service is being rendered effectively.
Or even at some point having a balance.
Exactly.
Between, I mean, since what you're doing as a police officer, you are policing our community.
Exactly.
Shouldn't we have some voice in helping to police ourselves in a sense? And I think doctors might push back because they're paying, hundreds of thousands of dollars every year in malpractice to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't have to protect themselves against anyone,
mm-hmm,
they would just move forward. Well, let's talk about what is happening on the ground. I know at Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, one of the wonderful things about your organization is that you keep your fingertips on the pulse, right? So you have a group that's intergenerational from millennials on up, and that people are really looking at what's happening. What is the current state of community and police relationships at this point?
Well, I mean, I think a part of the issue is that most people in communities, while there's an attempt, I think, on the part of law enforcement to kind of address the PR disaster of the uprising that
right.
it presented to
well,
them.
Well, now I'm going to add uprising because we can also talk about Tyrone West. His family's been
Absolutely.
Protesting every single Wednesday. Like, I'm so impressed by that.
Absolutely.
I think about what the police officer slapping the boy that just recently
mm-hmm.
happened. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's not just
right.
the uprising that's caused
right.
this major PR problem.
Right, right. And so a part of the issue is that, so while you have law enforcement, I think, trying to pivot towards community involvement, the problem is, and this goes back to the legislative piece, is there is no substantive mechanism by which community can be involved in the process of how policing is administered. And I think that's really important. When we talk about police-community relations, it obscures the fact that there's a power differential,
mm-hmm.
right? So community doesn't have a mechanism by which to hold police accountable in their communities, right? They're
right.
dealt with, left with whoever's in their communities. And so I think a part of what it's going to take in order to address police accountability is trying to find substantive ways of being of cooperation, right, between community and police. I've talked to some law enforcement officers kind of off the record who have said to me that it would be great to have civilians kind of involved in the process of administering policing so they can see what we see.
Mm.
Right, and get a greater appreciation of the things that we go through. There's research that says that when police are when civilians are substantively involved in policing in a community, that the community has a better impression of law enforcement because they're a part of the process
now,
of how it's administered.
Now, that same research said that also the community then has almost like a zero tolerance. Like they
mm-hmm,
recognize
mm-hmm.
that one broken window
mm-hmm.
can lead to bigger problems
mm-hmm.
down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've seen the research a little bit about what you're talking about,
exactly.
that the community is the one saying we need to deal with this. It's something small. Small now, but if
mm-hmm.
we don't deal with it,
mm-hmm.
we have seen cases where a small
mm-hmm.
thing
mm-hmm.
becomes a bigger thing.
Exactly. And so for us, in terms of our work, is trying to create a context where community can be involved beyond just the kind of dog and pony show sometimes of events around community police relations. You know, you see kind of pictures of, you know, police talking to community, police
dancing
coming.
Dancing with
you,
kids.
You know what I mean? And it's like, that's not the problem we have. The problem we have is, how do you make communities more safe in a way that the people in the communities feel like they're a part of the process of making them more safe? And currently, there's no mechanism that is allowed, because of the LEOBR, where people substantively are involved in that process.
What's interesting with you talking about this notion of feeling more comfortable with the police, I mean, that's a bigger question, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you feel comfortable when you have an issue calling on the police to come and assist you when there's a fear that they may be coming to hold you accountable for something that's not your fault?
Absolutely.
I mean, things like, I mean, I heard about like the officer next door program, where you want police officers to live in the community. Do you see your way in LBS as maybe that's a solution? Like, move into the community where you're policing so you can know the people there.
Yeah, I mean, see, the thing is, again, we want to be careful. Because, you know, there are folks in our communities historically that have had issues with law enforcement, and just having law enforcement closer in proximity doesn't necessarily solve the problem, right? Having law enforcement officers that are from the communities is a step. But again, if police officers feel like if they engage in some form of brutality against a civilian that nothing's going to happen to them, then there's no intrinsic incentive to go and build those relationships in a way where they feel accountable to community. And I think that's really the issue that we have to wrestle with, is that I had a conversation with a reporter early on the session, and I made this argument about the community having power in the relationship between police and community, not just being, you know, subjects of police officers. And what they had said to me, they were like, wow, you saying that makes sense. But there's a part of me that doesn't think it makes sense for a community to have power over police, right?
And I think rather than, you know, maybe shared power.
Right. So like shared power and shared power that would allow for community to not just be able to have an opinion, but to be able to have some say in how law enforcement operates. Because ultimately, if law enforcement serve our communities, then we would think that police officers will hold themselves accountable to communities in a way where they're really serving. But it requires, again, a mechanism in the law that allows for power to be shared. If it's not allowed for in the law, then it's really just a formality.
I mean, but listen to how that sounds. In order for the police to treat people better in their own communities, we need to have a law that forces them to do so.
Right.
We need to have somebody to hold them accountable to be able to be really, really honest and open and fair to the people that they're supposed to work for, right? We're charging you with this ability to give you a gun to take care of us, in a sense, because if your house gets broken into, you're not going to call me.
Right.
You're probably going to call the cops, but the idea they'll come in and do something. Now, I do want to know, I want to ask you, given that we are a month away from commemorating the death of Freddie Gray, and we're talking about that, what has happened? Is the community better now? I mean, it's been a year. Or are we still the same, or is it getting worse when we start talking about these relations?
I think that there is kind of a greater sense of community interested in transformation. And I think there are folks that are mobilized, and I think that there are more visible pathways to trying to address the issues that exist in our communities. But I think, unfortunately, the situation that was uncovered in the uprising is the ineptitude of the major institutions that have been doing work around these issues and actually addressing the problem. So I think in one sense, you know, we're better off in the sense that there are more folks that are mobilized and interested to really push forward to make a difference. But it's going to take some infrastructure building and sustainable grassroots mobilization that will create a kind of a change that we'll see long term. Because I think sometimes many of us get addicted to moments, you know, into incidents and events, event to event. But I think we're in the process, my organization and many others, in the process of sustainable movement building that we might not see this year, right? But if we build an infrastructure, put us in a better position to really change the institutional players that, have been inept at really substantively addressing these issues.
Now, it's interesting because as I've been going out in the communities talking to different groups, particularly young people, and asking them what they think about the uprising. How did the uprising change their lives? I'm not getting a lot of positive responses. The students, and this is not all students everywhere, of course, but the students I have talked to across the city are feeling very disgruntled. They felt like there was a moment and the moment just kind of flamed out. Like, how do we get our young people, and I'm not saying the ones who with LBS because you have a lot of young people involved, but young people who feel like their voices are not being heard or nothing has changed. My community, You know, we erupted in this moment. We made our stand. We were involved in this rebellion, and things are not happening. If I can't go to Annapolis, what can I do here in the city?
Well, I mean, I think a part of the source of that frustration is that, you know, political leadership, or really leadership of any kind that's sustainable on a big scale, you know, there are institutional mechanisms that allow that individual group to kind of be put forward. The problem is that I think a lot of our young people see the same people in charge of the institutions that govern their lives, not making different decisions about the nature of those institutions, their schools, after-school programs. They see all those things being pretty much the same with a few little cosmetic changes. And I think that creates the kind of anger from a lot of young folks who feel like the moment's gone. I think a part of our task is to figure out ways to explain to folks in our community, students and young folks, to get involved in something and to watch it grow. You know, because I think sometimes we want things to change right away, immediately. And a lot of the things that we see today in terms of the leadership and the way the power is configured, it took years to kind of build that power to where it is. So part of, I think, of our responsibility is to explain to young people, you know, get involved in something and be able to watch it grow so that maybe 5-10 years from now, you'll have the collective power to see new leadership and new decisions made about the institutions that govern their lives.
I just got an email from Michelle. Thank you so much for emailing me. But she is a teacher. She's a high school teacher. And she says she's trying to get her students to become more politically aware in this season. Like, we are at a pivotal moment here in Baltimore in terms of getting our new mayor. What are some steps that you think that she can take to get her youngsters, some of them who are 18, who are voting age, to be more politically aware, more politically involved?
Well, I mean, there needs to be more advocacy around investing resources in organizations that do that work. Because there are a lot of organizations that, you know, that can reach young people, that have ways to get young people involved. But a lot of times, you know, we don't have the resources and the capacity to reach out to enough students. I mean, LB, we wish we could reach out to more students, but we don't have the capacity. And so,
now wait a minute, let me ask you. Now, with your group, is it mostly college students, or do you have some high school students who are active?
It's a mix. It's a mix of high school and college students, primarily mentoring through debate, through policy debate. You know, but if we had more resources, and there are other organizations like that who do great work with young folks but don't have the capacity to do so. So I think that's a part of the issue. So exposing them to organizations that have young folks in them, you know, I think is one step in that direction.
So as we move forward and as we start thinking about our next steps, what is LBS doing to have people either A, start thinking more about the mayoral debates because people are not, because people are now thinking about other things like with what Trump is doing, and also B, getting them more involved with what's getting ready to happen in the city around the commemoration of the death of Freddie Gray, I guess thinking about the uprising or slash rebellion.
Right. Well, I mean, our focus right now is around the legislative piece because for us, we feel like, you know, if we don't change the legislative framework that kind of freezes out civilians and community folks, that we're not going to have long-term sustainable change. And so, like I said, the session is winding down. And then I think this state has an opportunity to either distinguish itself from the rest of the country or has an opportunity to demonstrate that it's not who it says it is, that this state isn't the progressive blue state that people proclaim is such a good thing about the state of Maryland. And so tonight, actually, is a subcommittee meeting in Annapolis that'll determine whether the amendments to the leadership bill that would allow civilian on the trial board and allow internal investigations to include non-law enforcement, we're going to see if those amendments are put on the bill. And that if it's not put on the bill, that essentially we're going to have a police reform bill that doesn't really address the issue of community empowerment. And our position has been that if a bill passed that is supposed to be police reform, that does not change the dynamic of police policing themselves, it's not police reform. Right. And that it would do is that in the future, in trying to change those parts of the law, if you pass this major bill, it'll make it harder to change those parts of the law, because what they're going to say to us is, oh, we've already dealt with police reform.
Oh, they won't bring it back.
Right.
Obviously.
Right. Right. So it will be years before we were even able to have a meaningful conversation about police reform in Annapolis. So this is really important because, again, the leadership wants to look good. They want to feel like they did something about police reform. But we have to insist that you have to change the composition of the trial board, and you have to allow for internal investigations to involve, like a civilian review board that's not law enforcement. If not, it's not police reform, and we should reject any bill that doesn't have those things in it. We're going to post on our website this evening the result.
Please give us your website.
So lbsbaltimore.com. You can also, we have a Facebook page, a Twitter page, and Instagram. So we're going to post, the outcome of this subcommittee meeting, whether these amendments are there. So if folks can call their legislators and just urge their legislators to support a version of this leadership bill on police reform that allows for a civilian to be on the trial board and that allows for internal investigations to involve non-law enforcement. Those are the two pieces that if it's not there, it's not police reform.
And they still have time to do this. If the meeting is happening tonight, mm-hmm. so you would recommend going online, finding out, first of all, who your representative
is, right.
and then giving a call. Is LBS heading down tonight?
Yeah, I'll be down there tonight.
Will you have a chance to testify, or are you just going to hear the vote tonight?
I'm just going to observe the meeting and observe what they decide.
Now, this process has been going on for a whole lot. Did you just start this after the uprising, or was this already in place and the uprising just added more fire to it?
Well, we were advocating on the same piece of legislation in the 2015 session.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, our Maryland General Assembly is 90 days, January to April. And so last year, it was the same legislative effort, but we couldn't even get it didn't even get out of committee. It didn't even come up for a vote, right? Because there wasn't the kind of atmosphere media-wise to prompt the legislature to feel like it was important enough to take on. So what the uprising did was it made it so legislators felt like they had to address it, as opposed to last year where they just kind of kept it in the drawer.
Well, let me ask you this, and I'm not a worst-case scenario person, but worst-case scenario, that vote happens tonight, and we do not get what we need. I mean, it's not really police reform. Like, what are the next steps after that?
Well, I mean, I've heard some organizations, you know, talk about, you know, mass civil disobedience. And
really?
I imagine, you know, we're coming up on a year's anniversary of the uprising. I imagine there'll be a lot of enthusiasm around mass demonstrations, particularly if Annapolis doesn't deliver to the community what it's asking for.
Mass demonstrations in Annapolis or mass demonstrations here in
Baltimore? I would say both. You know, here in Baltimore. But, you know, one of the things that's been, we've been very fortunate is that, you know, we've educated a lot of folks around the fact that law enforcement is governed by state law. You know, and so I think people understand the importance of what happens in Annapolis and its effect on Baltimore.
Well, thank you so much, Davon Love. I just love having an opportunity to talk to you. He's the Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. You can find the link to the LBS website that outlines what they are doing on our website, steinershow.org. Please log on tonight. Find out what the result of the vote is. Thank you for coming,
thank
Davon.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So what happens when you arm high school students with audio recorders, train them in how to write poetry, and then charge them with the responsibility of telling their own stories? Well, we will talk about all Baltimore voices, stories about and beyond the uprest. Stay with us as you listen to Black Rage by Lauryn Hill.
Black rage is founded on two-thirds a person, rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial, squeezed economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence.